go first. Out of the corner of my eye, I notice Fairy signal to a couple of the warriors in her command. They hustle forward and wrestle Adam to his feet. With Fairy leading the way, the Moogs drag Adam towards the invisible line that divides the cleared Mogadorian section of jungle with the untouched portion surrounding the temple. We've tried everything short of atomic bombardment to cross into the sanctuary, Fairy says conversationally. It said beloved leader knows a way in. It involves the guard and their little pendants. As you know, they've proven to be elusive. But if you believe the great book, and I do, then you know nothing can stand in the way of Mogadorian progress. Which means this damned force field will come down. I intend to trample whatever Loric magic is keeping us out, in the name of beloved leader. Then why haven't you done it already? Adam replies. If nothing can stand in the way of Mogadorian progress, why aren't you making any? Maybe because I never had a pretty trueborn boy's face to use as a battering ram. Marina and I reach the nearest turret. Together, we climb up the steps on the back of the blaster. The thing looks like a mounted jackhammer. There is a windshield with a crosshairs placed over the barrel. There are two handles for turning the gun, with triggers that look like the brakes of a bicycle set next to them. Will you be able to fire this thing? I whisper to Marina. Aim, squeeze, shoot, Marina whispers back. It's pretty intuitive, Six. All right, I reply. Hold on. The gun turret requires two hands to operate. Even though all the Moogs are facing away from us, I don't want to go visible and chance one of them glancing back and ruining our ambush. I carefully place my hand on the back of Marina's neck before letting go of her hand. This way, she's able to operate the turret while the two of us still remain invisible. Slowly, Marina starts moving the turret so that it's pointed at the Moogs. The gun needs oiling. It makes a metallic whine when she moves it. I wave my free hand in the air and quickly summon a strong gust of wind to cover the sound. Let me give you a preview of what you're in for, Fairy is saying. She's got Adam right in front of the invisible barrier now, her goons forcing him onto his knees. She unwraps the bandages around one of her hands, revealing horribly charred flesh. This is what the Loric shield does when we mistakenly run up against it. You should be more careful, Adam replies. At a nod from Fury, the two warriors grapple Adam into a half-bent position, securing his arm so that they can press it against the force field. Fury leers down at Adam. There are rumors about you, Sutek. They say you're part guard now. Maybe you're just what we need to get into the sanctuary. Maybe a freak like you will short-circuit the force field, and today will be the day we enter the sanctuary in the name of beloved leader. One way or another, today's your last day at the sanctuary, Adam replies through gritted teeth. I promise you that. Adam's words make Fury hesitate. She glances back towards our ship, suddenly realizing that maybe Adam didn't come alone. She's too late. Marina has the turret lined up on the crowd of Moogs. Ready? She whispers to me. Light him up. Marina's invisible hands squeeze down the turret's triggers. The gun roars to life with such force that I'm nearly knocked off the back. I manage to cling to Marina so that she doesn't turn visible. The closest group of Moogs don't even have a chance to turn around as glowing columns of sizzling blaster fire pummel their backs, turning them immediately to ash. As soon as Marina opens fire, dust comes screeching down from the sky. Now in the shape of a gray-winged falcon, The chimera rakes its talons across the face of one of the warriors holding Adam. The Moogs shout and scatter. They're totally confused. It must look like their turret has been possessed by a ghost. Fury Dunra has the presence of mind to squeeze off some blaster fire that deflects off the turret's windshield, but then she ducks for cover. Marina continues to strafe them, although she's careful to avoid the area around Adam. With dust taking down one of the warriors, Adam elbows his second captor in the stomach. When he doubles over, Adam shoves him backwards, right into the invisible border around the sanctuary. With a flare of cold, blue energy, the shield surrounding the temple reveals itself. It's like a giant electrical web stretched into the shape of a dome. The Moog flares up like the tip of a matchstick when he hits the force field. His body leaves a coating of ash that seems to float in the air once the shield disappears again, until a gentle gust of wind blows it away. Freed from his captors, Adam throws himself onto his stomach. Right away, Marina swings the turret around to take out the Moogs cluttered around him. A few of them, including Fury Dunra, have made it to the cover of one of the parked ships. Even though they can't see us, they return fire on the turret. Our gun soon begins to belch smoke and rattle dangerously. "It's overheating," I yell. "Jump!" Marina and I dive in opposite directions as the turret explodes in a cloud of acrid black smoke. We're visible and without any cover to speak of. Before the surviving Moogs can take aim, Adam pounds his fist against the ground. A tremor ripples in their direction and knocks the Moogs off their feet. I use the distraction to roll beneath one of the other ships, already channeling my legacy to call down a storm. The sky darkens, and it begins to rain. Out here in the jungle, it's a cinch to call up this kind of weather, but I'm still a few seconds away from channeling lightning, and I'm not sure I'll be quick enough. Fury and her troops are already drawing a bead on me, their blaster fire scorching the wet dirt in front of my position. That's when a fist-sized hailstone strikes Fury right in her bald head. She falls back, shielding herself. I notice Marina hiding behind a stack of crates. She's focusing intently on the raindrops, turning them to ice around the Moogs and knocking them senseless with hail. I feel the storm above reach a boiling point and let loose with a jagged stripe of lightning. Fury manages to dive aside at the last second, but her last two warriors are electrocuted into dust. And then, to my surprise, Fury Dunra runs. Without even a look over her shoulder, the Moog Trueborn bolts into the nearby jungle. Adam leaps to his feet. Both his lips are split open where Fury clubbed him, blood trickling down his chin. Otherwise, he looks unharmed and alert. He starts to run after Fury, his feet sliding through the reddish-brown mud my storm has created. Fury is out of sight before Adam can get very far. He pulls up short a few yards away from me. "Let her go," I tell him, willing the storm I whipped up to taper off.
"Shouldn't we go after her?"
Adam asks, spitting blood into the dirt. His eyes scan the nearby ruins and tree line, and I can tell he'd like a fair fight against the other Trueborn. Dust, back in wolf form, lopes over and sits down next to Adam, lapping gently at his hand. He glances back to me. "Thanks for the save, by the way." "Yeah, I figured since the whole distraction thing was my call, I kinda owed it to you to not let you get slaughtered."
"Glad you saw it that way," Adam replies, then looks back towards the ruins around the sanctuary.
"We should catch her. She's dangerous." "Forget about Fury What's-Her-Face," I say, turning away from the jungle and gazing up at the waiting temple. "We've got more important things to do than chase down one Moog," Marina puts in as she walks over to join us.
no matter how nasty she might be. I nod in agreement. She's alone out there. Maybe something will eat her. We'll leave Dust back here to keep watch over the ships, in case she tries to double back. Adam continues to stare into the jungle. After a moment, he finally nods his head.
Fine. I'll keep an eye on things while you guys go inside.
I exchange an inquiring look with Marina to make sure she doesn't have any misgivings with what I'm about to say. She shrugs her shoulders in response, then starts towards our ship to begin the unloading. I cock my head at Adam.
You don't even want to try coming in with us? I ask.
Adam stares at me.
Are you joking? Did you see what contact with that field did to Firi Dunra?
I'll heal you if that happens, Marina offers over her shoulder.
I don't understand, Adam says.
He turns to look up at the temple, his hands on his hips. He looks nervous.
Why would you even want me to go in there? It's a Loric place.
Like that fairy bitch said, you're part guard now, I explain. You're not Loric, but you've got legacies.
I've got one legacy, Adam clarifies, and it wasn't even mine to start with.
I'm not even sure if I'm supposed to have it.
Doesn't matter.
If I understood what Malcolm told us, and I guess that's maybe a big if, there's a living piece of Lorien in that temple. That's where our legacies come from, which means you're connected to it, just like us. Everything has happened for a reason, Marina says as she climbs up onto our ship's hull. She looks back at us, a thoughtful frown straining her soft features. Just look at 8's prophecies.
Adam looks unconvinced. He swallows hard. We don't know what's waiting for us in there, or what to expect. We might need you in there. So, man up.
I'm not sure how Adam will respond to being called out. A smile flickers across his face, like that one in the cockpit when he was spacing out.
I'm in, he says, assuming that invisible wall doesn't burn my face off.
We walk over to the ship to help Marina. She pulls the chest with our gathered inheritance out of the cockpit and floats it down to me with telekinesis. Then she carefully floats 8's body out of the ship. She has him hover right in front of her, almost like she was carrying him in her arms. To my surprise, she unzips the top half of the body bag. There's 8, looking just as he did when he was alive, those Mogadorian electrodes preserving him.
Marina? What are you doing?
I want him to see the sanctuary, she says. Then gently smooths some of 8's curly hair back from his forehead.
You're going home, she whispers to him.
Marina climbs down from the ship, focusing her telekinesis so that 8's body stays with her the entire way. There's a look of deep purpose on her face, and she doesn't even look at me or Adam before walking towards the temple. I realize that she's been waiting days for this moment, the time when she can properly lay 8 to rest. Wordlessly, Adam and I join her somber procession. As we approach the edge of the land the Moogs cleared, the wild and overgrown temple looming before us, I feel a strange tickle against my chest. I look down to find John's pendant glowing brightly and rising up against the front of my tank top. I adjust my shirt, and the pendant floats out in front of me, straining against its chain. It's like it's magnetically drawn to the sanctuary. The 2 pendants Marina wears are doing the same thing. Adam gives me a look and arches an eyebrow at my gravity-defying jewelry. I shrug in response. This is all new to me, too. Marina is the first to pass over the threshold. The force field appears again, cobalt and electric, and there's a static popping as she passes through it. Loose tangles of her hair, charged by the energy, float up around her head, but otherwise nothing happens. I'm only a few steps behind her.
The force field gives my skin a fizzy feeling. It only lasts a second, and then I'm standing on the other side, the cracked and vine-riddled steps of the sanctuary rising up before me. I turn back to check on Adam. He's stopped right in front of the force field. Cautiously, he extends his index finger and makes contact with the energy. It pops loudly and he jumps back, but he isn't scorched like the other Mogadorian was. "You sure this is a good idea?"
"Don't be a wimp," I reply.
Adam sighs, steels himself, and reaches forward again, this time with his whole hand. The energy crackles and sparks against his pale skin way more than it did with Marina and me, but it lets him through without incinerating him. I grin at him, and he gives me a relieved look, wiping some sweat off his forehead.
"Now what?" he asks.
Marina has paused a few yards in front of us, still floating Eight's body. She reaches behind her head and takes off one of her pendants. Loosed from her neck, the pendant bobs slowly towards the stone steps of the temple, and then begins to rise up them.
"We climb," Marina says.
Her pendant glints blue in the sunlight, and it occurs to me that the laurelite is glowing a little brighter, like it's charged up or something. I feel it, too. The sanctuary is giving off some kind of energy beyond just the force field. There's a sense that every cell in my body has been suddenly invigorated. I glance up to the sky, and know that I could call up a larger storm than ever before. I feel more in touch with my legacies. And somehow it all seems so natural, like I've known this feeling before. Marina was right, I realize. We're home. Chapter 25. It takes us about 30 minutes to climb to the top of the Mayan pyramid. I try passing the time by counting the steps, but I lose track somewhere around 200. There are sections where the stone steps have crumbled into ankle-twisting crevices, and other spots where rain has eroded the ancient stonework down to smooth slopes. We use the overgrown vines that spill forth from the jungle to assist us over the difficult parts, ascending hand over hand. We don't talk much, except to tell each other when a particularly tricky section of steps is coming. Somehow, it seems rude to disturb the silence of the sanctuary. We take a break once we reach the top of the temple. Marina is sweating from the heat, the climb, and the exertion of using her telekinesis to carry Eight's body for so long. I set down the chest I've been carrying and flex my fingers. Adam stands with his hands on his hips and gazes out over the temple's edge.
"Some view," he says.
"It's beautiful," I agree. At the temple's pinnacle, we are above the treetops. It's possible to see beyond the overgrown trees that crowd the pyramid, beyond the stripped ring of land the Moogs cleared, and out to the rest of the Mayan ruins and the thriving jungle beyond. I imagine some old Mayan ruler standing up here and gazing out at his domain. And then, I imagine that same ruler turning his eyes to the heavens as a Lorik ship descends from the clouds. The image seems so real and vivid, I get the strange feeling that my imagination didn't just conjure it up. Centuries ago, something like that really happened here. The Lorik visited, and the sanctuary remembers.
"You guys, look at this," Marina calls to us.
Adam and I turn away from the view and walk across the flat roof of the temple. At the centermost point is a stone door. At first, I think the door is carved from the same pale stone as the rest of the pyramid, but as I draw closer, it becomes obvious that the door is smooth and unblemished, the ivory-colored material not showing the same effects of age as the rest of the temple. The door may have been here for some time, yet it's apparent that it was plunked down on top of the already built pyramid. The door doesn't lead anywhere, a fact Marina demonstrates by walking in a circle around it. Her floating pendant hovers in front of the door, waiting for us to catch up. I stop in front of the door and examine its surface. It is completely smooth. No handles, knobs, or anything like that, with the exception of 9 round divots arranged in a circle at the door's center. "The pendants," I say, brushing my fingers over cool stone. Marina plucks her pendant out of the air and guides the stone into one of the notches. It fits perfectly and emits a crisp clicking sound. The door doesn't move, though. "We only have 3, I say, grimacing. "It isn't enough." "We have to try," Marina says, already pulling off her remaining pendant. She's right. We've come too far to turn back now. I pull off John's pendant and fit it into the notches on the stone door. "Here goes nothing," I say, as I push the final pendant home. Immediately, the laurelite stones begin to glow with the same energy as the force field. The glow spreads between the stones, connecting them, the energy filling the gaps where we're missing pendants. The circular symbol that takes shape on the door reminds me of the scars we get on our legs when one of the guard dies. And then, with an ancient grinding noise, the stone door slides down into the temple, leaving behind only a thin frame. Instead of jungle through the doorframe, I see a dusty room lit by the dim blue glow of laurelite. "I thought we'd need more," I say. "We don't even have a majority." "Or maybe the sanctuary knows how badly we need to enter," Marina suggests. "It's some kind of portal," Adam says, squinting into the room beyond the doorframe. "Is that inside the temple?" "Let's find out," I say. I pick up Marina's chest and step over the threshold. Immediately, I get that disorienting, end-over-end roller coaster feeling that I used to have whenever 8 would use his teleportation legacy. It only lasts a second, and then I'm blinking my eyes to adjust to the dimmer lighting of this inner sanctum. My ears pop from the pressure change, and I get the sense that I just stepped through a portal into the middle of the Mayan temple. Or maybe, considering the way the jungle sounds have been completely sealed out, we're even deeper than that. Maybe this sanctuary is completely beneath the pyramid. Marina, with 8's body in tow, and Adam follow me through, the both of them squinting to adjust to the lower light. When they're on the other side, the doorway blinks out of existence. There's no exit in its place. Only a solid limestone wall, although a circle of notches just like the one from the door are carved into it. Our pendants clatter to the floor, and I hurriedly pick them up. "The sanctuary," Marina breathes. "How long ago did your people put this here?" Adam asks. "Hell if I know. We heard they'd been coming to Earth for centuries," I reply absently, peering around. "I guess this is what they were doing." "They were preparing for this day," Marina adds, that eerie certainty back in her voice. "What did they leave us, though?" I ask, a little disappointed as I look around. "An empty room?" The sanctuary is one long, rectangular room with high ceilings and absolutely no doors or windows. It's as if our ancestors teleported into a solid chunk of rock, somehow managed to carve out a room, and then forgot to furnish it. There's nothing here. Veins of glowing laurelite are threaded through the stone walls and ceiling in chaotic patterns that cast the entire room in a cobalt hue. My eyes glide over the swoops and swirls of laurelite. There's something vaguely familiar there. Something that I'm just not seeing. "It's the universe," Adam says. "It's more than we even know about. The Mogadorian star maps don't cover this much." It takes me a moment to realize what he's saying.
But then, I noticed the way the laurelite veins pool into circles at some spots, and I recognized the other veins as the swirling stars of the cosmos and beyond. It's just like the macrocosms, only way bigger, and covering way more universe. I find Lorien on one wall, the glowing puddle of laurelite at its heart shining much dimmer than some other spots. Our home, I say, and touch Lorien gently with my finger. A chill goes through me as the laurelite seems to pulse in answer, almost as if it recognizes me.
My home, Adam says dryly. He points to an area that's notable only for its complete absence of laurelite, like a void existing in the glowing universe. He frowns. At least your ancestors got the whole forbidding darkness thing right.
Those aren't our homes. Not anymore, Marina says, tracing her fingers across the wall, following the exact trajectory our ship took from Lorien to Earth. This is our home now. The laurelite outline of Earth glows much stronger than any other section of the wall. Marina presses her fingers against it, and the laurelite crackles and vibrates. Something below us is moving. Dust and dirt shake loose from the ceiling, the motes sparkling in the suddenly hypercharged light of the laurelite. I know I shouldn't be scared. This is a lauric place. It won't hurt us. But I can't help backing up to the nearest wall. The sanctuary suddenly feeling very claustrophobic now that it's shaking around me. Adam stumbles in next to me, his eyes wide. With an ancient groan and a grinding of stone, a circular section of the floor at the room's center rises up. It's like an altar or a pedestal extending up from the floor. The room stops shaking when the thing has risen to about waist high. This new extension is made from pure laurelite. The slab of plain limestone floor sits atop the laurelite cylinder, almost like a seal holding in whatever might be down below. Cautiously, the three of us approach. It looks like this piece comes off, I say, touching the limestone seal, but not yet removing it. It almost looks like a well, Adam says, musing.
What do you think is down there?
No clue, I reply. Look, Marina says. The drawings. I see them. They're similar to the cave paintings that Eight showed us back in India, except these are carved directly into the well's laurelite sides. I have to walk a circle around the well to take all the images in. Nine silhouettes looming over a planet that looks like Earth, with nine smaller silhouettes standing on the planet below them. A person, I can't tell if it's a male or female, standing in front of a hole in the ground and dumping the contents of a box into the opening. Nine silhouettes again, this time arranged in front of a castle, fending off something that looks like a tidal wave, or maybe a three-headed dragon. More prophecies? I ask.
Maybe,
Marina replies. She has paused in front of the carving of the person with the box.
Or maybe they're instructions.
I stand next to her. Do you think this is the place where we, commit our inheritances to the earth? Marina nods. She sets Eight's body gently down to the ground, then uses her telekinesis to push the slab of limestone that seals the well aside. It crumbles onto the ground with a huge thud, the old stone instantly breaking apart. A column of pure blue light flows up from the well, so bright that I have to shield my eyes. It's like a spotlight. I can feel the warmth from the light deep in my bones. This is... Adam trails off, unable to complete his thought. There's profound amazement in his dark, Mogadorian eyes. Marina kneels down in front of her chest and opens it up. She cups her hands and removes a handful of lauric gemstones, then drops them into the sanctuary's well. They glitter and flash as they slip through her fingers, falling into the light.
In response, the whole room seems to get a little brighter. The laurelite veins in the walls pulse stronger.
"Help me, Six," Marina says excitedly.
I grab the pouch of soil from the chest, open it up, and dump the contents down the well. A fragrant, greenhouse-like aroma fills the dusty chamber, and the light grows stronger still. Marina follows the soil with the bundle of dried branches and leaves. In that moment before they leave her hand, while they're bathed in the light, I could swear the branches look green and alive again. As they drop out of sight, a swirling breeze fills the chamber, cooling us down. "It's working," I say, even though I'm not sure what exactly we're doing. I'm only sure that it feels right. When we've emptied out the chest of everything else, I pick up the can of Henri's ashes. Carefully, I remove the lid and empty it into the light. Each of the ashes briefly sparks as they swirl downward into the well. I wish John could have been here to see this. I turn back to Marina, inclining my head gently towards where Eight's body rests on the ground. "Should we?" Marina shakes her head, looking down at Eight. "I'm not ready yet, Six." I take a moment to sweep my gaze over the room, checking to see if anything's changed. The light from the well is nearly as bright as the sun, but it doesn't really hurt my eyes anymore. The laurelite veins in the walls pulse with energy. Our chest is empty, and Henri's ashes have been spread. "There's nothing else to do," I say to Marina. "It's time." "The pendants, Six," Marina says. "We have to give it the pendants."
"Hold on," Adam says, stepping forward for the first time. He's been watching all this take place with awe, but Marina's words snap him back. "If you drop those pendants down there, we'll have no way out of here."
I'm still holding all of our pendants. I clutch them tightly as I think it over. "We have to have faith, right?" I say, shrugging my shoulders. "We have to trust that whatever's down there, whatever the elders left for us, that it'll show us a way out."
Marina nods.
"Yes." Adam looks at me for a moment, then to the light. Everything he's seen today must go against his Mogadorian instincts. But he has guard in him, too.
"All right," Adam says. "I trust you."
I hold on to the pendants for a moment longer. I've worn an amulet around my neck for most of my life. There were many times that it reminded me who I was, where I was from, and what I was fighting for. It was heartbreaking to lose two pendants, and I've never felt right without one. It's as much a part of who I am, who we all are, as the scars on our ankles. But it's time to let that go. I drop the three pendants into the well. The response is immediate and blinding. The light from within the well goes supernova. I shout and shield my eyes, and I'm pretty sure Marina and Adam do the same. There is a whooshing sound from down below, like thousands of wings taking flight, or a miniature tornado touching down beneath the earth. There is a loud, baritone thump that sends vibrations through my teeth. A few seconds later, the sound repeats. Thump, 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 thump. The rhythm gets faster and stronger, steadier. It's a heartbeat. I'm not sure how long I'm bathed in that pure blue light, how long I listen to the sonorous heartbeat of Lorien. It could be 2 minutes, or it could be 2 hours. The experience is hypnotic and comforting. When the light begins to die down, and the volume of the heartbeat lowers to a steady thrum in the background, I almost miss it. It's like waking up from a warm dream that you don't want to leave. I open my eyes and immediately gasp. Eight's body hovers upright over the sanctuary's well, the column of blue light surrounding him. I snatch at Marina's hand.
Are you doing this?
I ask, unintentionally shouting. Marina shakes her head and squeezes my hand. There are tears in her eyes. A few steps behind us, Adam is on his knees. He must have collapsed during the light show. He looks up at 8, completely mystified.
What's happening? What is this?
Look at him, Marina says.
Look.
I'm about to tell Adam I have no idea what's going on, when I see 8's fingers move.
Was it just a trick of the light?
No, Marina must have seen it too, because she makes a little squeaking sound and covers her mouth with her free hand, her other squeezing down hard on mine.
8 wiggles his fingers. Floating. He shakes out his arms and legs. He rolls his head as if working out a crick in his neck.
Then he opens his eyes. They are pure laurelite. 8's eyes glow the same cobalt shade as the deepest veins in the wall. When he opens his mouth, blue light comes flooding out.
Hello,
8 says, in an echoing voice that doesn't belong to our friend. It's a melodic, beautiful voice, like nothing I've ever heard before.
It is the voice of Lorien.
Chapter 26. Most people have the sense to run. These New Yorkers have seen enough movies to know what happens when an alien spaceship parks itself over your city. They stream down the sidewalk in droves. Some even abandon their cars in the middle of the avenues, which makes it slow going for our convoy of black SUVs. Luckily, outside Sanderson's hotel, Agent Walker was able to convince the local cops who showed up in response to the shooting to help us. When it comes to alien invasions, I guess there's something about a federal agent in a black suit and sunglasses. Even with the added sirens and flashers of the NYPD, it's hard cutting through the city, through the chaos. And yet, some people aren't running away from the East River, where the Mogadorian warship hovers ominously over the United Nations. They're running towards it. People with their phones out, recording, eager to catch a glimpse of alien life. I can't make up my mind if they're brave, crazy, or just stupid. Probably a combination of the three. I want to shout out the window for them to turn and run, but there's no time. I won't be able to save all of them. Michael Worthington, a senator representing Florida. Agent Walker barks the name into her cell phone, reading it off a yellow legal pad. She's in the passenger seat, looking harried and wild. She knows there's not enough time for her orders to make a difference, but she's giving them anyway. Melissa Croft, she's on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Luke Philippe, the French ambassador. Walker pauses, reaching the end of her list. She glances into the back seat, where Bud Sanderson is sandwiched in between me and Sam.
Is that everyone?
Sanderson nods.
Everyone that I know of.
Walker nods and speaks into the phone.
Arrest them. Yes, all of them. If they resist, kill them.
She hangs up the phone. The list of politicians associated with MogPro, dozens of names relayed one by one by Walker to her contacts, came courtesy of Sanderson. Even if the rogue agents Walker has in her command can pull it off, the arrests might not do much good now, at the zero hour. At the very least, we have to hope Walker and her people will knock the Moog-friendly traitors out of power, leaving behind a government that's ready to resist. Although, how much resistance they'll be able to mount remains to be seen. How long did Henri tell me it took the Moogs to conquer Lorien? Less than a day? Through the windshield, the Mogadorian warship is visible. It makes the city's skyscrapers look like toys and casts blocks-long shadows in every direction. The thing looks like a giant roach poised over New York. There are hundreds of blaster turrets along its sides and on its belly, and I think I can make out openings where smaller Moog ships are probably docked. Even with the full guard, legacies blazing, I'm not sure we could take down that hulk. Agent Walker is staring at the ship, too. I guess it's probably impossible to ignore the massive alien object that crowds the horizon. She turns to look at me.
You can destroy that thing, right?
Sure, I reply, trying to mimic Nine's casual bluster. He's in the SUV behind ours, probably explaining to his escort of agents how he'll rip apart that warship with his bare hands. We got this. No problem. Next to me, Sanderson chuckles darkly, but shuts up when Walker fixes him with a menacing look. On the other side of the disgraced Secretary of Defense, Sam finally looks up from the cell phone he borrowed from that innocent bystander outside the hotel.
The upload is done, he says to me. Sarah's got the footage.
Thanks, Sam, I reply, and pull my own phone out from my pocket, immediately dialing Sarah's number. I wonder what Henri would think of me and Sam uploading footage of me using my legacies to the website of They Walk Among Us. In my wildest dreams, I don't think I could have concocted a scenario where I'd willingly take my powers public. But here we are. Sarah answers on the first ring. I can hear activity in the background, people talking, a television blaring.
John, thank God. The Moogs are all over the news. Are you okay?
I'm fine, I tell her. Just making my way towards the biggest Mogadorian ship I've ever seen.
John, I hope you know what you're doing,
Sarah replies, worry in her voice. It's nothing we can't handle. I start to reassure her, until a blast of static cuts me off. Sarah, are you there?
I'm here,
she replies, sounding a little more distant than before.
I think something's interfering with the connection, though.
It must be the warships. I'm sure those huge things coming down from orbit aren't doing any favors for the cellular networks. Not to mention all the panicked phone calls like this one that must be going on around the country. I have to talk quicker, in case I lose service. Sam just sent some video files to Mark's website. Did you guys get them? I think they could be useful. I remember what Sam said to me outside the gas station. We don't want to just scare people. We also want to give them hope. Next to me, Bud Sanderson snorts. I guess the old man doesn't have too much faith in anything we're doing on They Walk Among Us. I don't know if it's going to work either. Like Walker's arrests, like anything we do today, it might be too late for it to matter. We've got to cover every possible angle of fighting back against the Moogs.
I'm looking at it now, Sarah says, and her breath catches. John, you're amazing. But I'm a sucker for handsome aliens performing miracles.
I've been trying to look stone-faced in front of my uneasy allies, so I have to turn away from Sanderson to hide my smile.
Thanks. We can definitely use this, Sarah says, and I can hear her already tapping out keystrokes. What are you going to do now, though? That ship looks huge.
I glance at the chaos outside the window. We're going to try to end this war before it gets started. Sarah's voice sounds concerned. She knows I'm about to tell her something crazy.
What do you mean, John? What's the plan?
We're going to the Mogadorian warship, I tell her, trying to sound confident about a plan that seems more desperate the closer we get to that looming warship. We're going to lure Cetricus Ra out, and we're going to kill him. Our convoy has to stop 10 blocks short of the United Nations when the traffic becomes impassable. The streets are clogged with people trying to get a closer look at the warship. Some of them are even standing on top of cars or, in one case, a stalled city bus. There are cops everywhere, trying their best to restore some order, but I doubt they're trained for first contact scenarios. Most of them are busy staring up at the ship, too. The crowd is buzzing, and there's a lot of excited shouting. Just a bunch of easy targets for the Mogadorians. I dread the moment those cannons along the sides of the warship open fire on this crowd. I want to tell everyone to run, but that might just start a panic. If anyone would even listen to me.
Move! Get out of the way!
Walker screams as she gets out of the SUV. She's got her badge in the air, although no one's really paying attention to her. The agents from the two SUVs, along with the cops Walker recruited back at the hotel, form a tight perimeter around me, Sanderson, and Sam. Nine shoves his way in next to us, glaring at a group of teenagers, cheering encouragement at the spaceship.
Idiots, he grumbles, then looks at me. This is nuts, Johnny!
We need to protect as many as we can, I reply.
They need to protect themselves, Nine says, then shouts over the shoulder of one of our agents. Go home, you morons, or get some guns and come back!
Walker glares at him. Please don't encourage the civilians to get armed. Nine gives her a wild look and keeps shouting.
It's war, lady! These people need to get prepared!
Some of the people around us have overheard, or maybe they're just unnerved by the growing police presence. I notice a few exchange nervous looks, and people begin trickling back the way they came. Walker grimaces at Nine, then slaps one of the agents on the shoulder.
Forward! She shouts. We need to move forward!
There's still a mob separating us from the UN, and it shows no signs of really thinning out. Walker's agents and the cops start muscling through, and we're carried along with them.
Watch it, dude! No cutting in line to get beamed up!
Shouts one bystander.
Holy shit, it's the men in black! Screams another.
Are they going to hurt us?
A woman we pass yells at Sanderson, maybe recognizing him as someone important looking.
Are we in danger?
Sanderson averts his eyes, and soon the woman is lost in the crowd. It's slow going, even with a dozen cops and agents bull rushing ahead of us. These people need to get out of our way. A wild-eyed guy with a scraggly beard who looks like the type to be waving handmade signs about the end of the world, barrels right into Agent Walker. She's thrown off balance, and I reach out to steady her. Walker doesn't thank me. There's fury and frustration in her eyes. Fed up with the crowd, she reaches for the gun holstered on her hip, maybe thinking she'll fire a few shots in the air to clear the area. I stop her arm and shake my head when she glares at me.
Don't! You'll start a panic.
This is already a panic, she replies.
Personally, I'd be panicking more if someone was shooting, Sam chimes in.
Walker makes an annoyed noise and goes back to pushing her way through the crowd. I elbow Nine in the ribs.
Let's help them, I tell him, adding, but don't hurt anyone.
Nine nods, and we begin using telekinesis to move people out of our way. Nine's gentler than I would have expected. We create a sort of telekinetic bubble around us, the nearby bystanders sliding off it. No one gets trampled, and slowly the path starts to clear for Walker and the rest of our escort. As we move closer to the UN, we come directly under the shadow of the Mogadorian warship. A chill goes through me. But I try not to let it show. There are flags of every nation planted in the ground on both sides of the road we're pressing down. All these symbols flapping in a gentle spring breeze, caught beneath the looming Mogadorian vessel. Up ahead, I see that a stage has been hastily erected at the front entrance of the UN. There is a more organized police force there, both local cops and the UN's private security. They keep people away from the stage and from storming the entrance to the main building. There's a concentration of press up ahead, too, all of them with cameras eagerly swinging between the stage and the hovering spacecraft. I grab Sanderson around the shoulders and yank him close, pointing to the stage.
What's the deal with that? What's supposed to happen here?
Sanderson grimaces at me, but doesn't try to wriggle away.
The beloved leader has a taste for theatrics. Did you know he wrote a book?
Reading is stupid, grunts Nine,
more focused on the crowd. I don't care about his propaganda. Explain the stage, Sanderson.
Propaganda, like you said, Sanderson replies. Myself and some of the others from Moog Pro, the ones our dear friend Walker probably had arrested, we were supposed to greet Cetricus Ra. He was going to demonstrate the gifts the Mogadorians could offer humanity.
I remember the state we found Sanderson in, all black-veined and nearly keeled over, all strung out on the Mogadorians' so-called medical advancements. He was going to heal you, I say, putting it together.
Hallelujah, Sanderson says bitterly. Our savior. Then we'd invite him inside the UN for discussions, and come tomorrow, a peaceful resolution would be adopted to allow the Moogs into the airspace of every member nation.
And that's it, Sam says. Earth would be surrendered.
At least it would be peaceful, Sanderson says.
Don't you think people would freak out? I ask Sanderson. I mean, look around. Imagine what will happen when the Moogs actually show themselves, start walking around, taking things over. There'd be panic, riots, even with your bullshit diplomacy. How is your plan ever going to work?
Of course he thought of that, Sanderson says. That's how Cetricus Ra plans to identify the dissidents, the problem elements.
So he'll know who to kill,
Nine grunts.
That's sick, Sam says.
A small price to pay for humanity's survival, Sanderson argues.
I've seen the future under Mogadorian rule, I tell Sanderson. Believe me, it's a bigger price than you're willing to pay. Sam gives me a worried look, and I realize how cold I must sound. Like war with the Mogadorians on Earth is inevitable. Like there's nothing we can do at this point to keep people from getting hurt. In truth, I'm not sure that there is a way to resolve this without bloodshed. The war is here, and it's going to be fought. But I need the others to keep up hope. It doesn't have to be that way, I add. We're going to stop Cetricus Ra before this goes any further, but you have to help us.
Sanderson nods, his eyes fixed on the stage.
You want me to go through with it?
Draw him out just like he wants, I say, pulling up the hood on my sweatshirt, and we'll take him down.
You're powerful enough for that.
As I look over at Sanderson to respond, I can see the same question in Sam's eyes. He wasn't at our last fight with Cetricus Ra, but he knows it didn't go well. That was with the whole guard. Now it's just me and Nine. Well, and all the guns Agent Walker can bring to bear. I have to be, I tell Sanderson. As we get closer to the front of the UN and the stage, we pass by a guy dressed like a bike messenger, surrounded by a few news cameras. It's noticeable, because he's the only thing commanding any press attention around here, besides the giant Mogadorian warship. I focus my senses to hear what he's saying.
I swear the guy fell out of the sky,
the bike messenger exclaims to a skeptical press corps.
Well, maybe he floated down. I don't know. He hit the ground hard, but his skin was, like, covered in armor or something. He looked all sorts of messed up.
Nine's hand clamps down on my shoulder. He heard it, too. And he's so distracted that he stops telekinetically pushing people aside. The agents escorting a shuffle and groan as the crowd surges in, but they manage to keep them back.
You heard that, right?
Nine asks, his eyes practically glowing with bloodlust. He could just be some nut job, I say, referring to the bike messenger, although I don't really believe it.
This kind of thing definitely brings them out.
No way,
Nine says, excitement in his voice. His eyes dart around the crowd with a renewed interest.
Five is here, man. Five is here, and I'm going to smash his fat face in!
Chapter 27. I feel numb. In the docking bay, I catch a glimpse of myself in the pearl-colored armor paneling of the small ship we'll be taking to Manhattan. I look ghostly. There are huge bags under my eyes. They dressed me up in a new formal gown, black with red sashes throughout, and pulled my hair back in a ponytail so severe that my scalp feels like it's peeling away from my skull. Princess of the Mogadorians. I don't really care. I've got a cloudy feeling, like I'm just floating along. A part of me knows that I should be focusing up, getting my head straight. I just can't. The entrance to the transport ship opens, and a small staircase unfolds for me to climb up. Cetricus Rod gently places his hand on my shoulder and urges me forward.
Here we go, dear,
he says. His voice sounds far away.
Big day.
I don't move at first, but then a pain starts up in my shoulder where I was stabbed. It feels like little worms wiggling around under my skin. The ache only subsides when I put one foot in front of the other, climb up the steps, and flop onto one of the vessel's bucket seats. Good, Cetricus Ross says, and follows me aboard. He sits down in the pilot's seat, and the ship seals up behind us. His human form has been restored after his scuffle with Five, and he's dressed himself in a sleek black suit with crimson flourishes. The color scheme doesn't complement the fatherly human face he's wearing. It makes him look stern and authoritative. I don't tell him that, both because I don't want to help him and because it seems like too much effort to talk. I wish I could just sleep through this. They did something to me after the gash opened up on my shoulder. I was in and out of consciousness from blood loss, so my memory is foggy. I can remember Cetricus Ra carrying me down to the medical bay, a place on the ship I hadn't had the bad luck to explore until then. I remember them injecting my wound with something black and oozing. I'm pretty sure that I screamed from the pain. But then, my wound started to close. It wasn't like the times I'd been healed by Marina or John. In those cases, it felt like my injuries were knitting back together, like my flesh was regrowing. Under the Moog's care, it felt like my flesh was being replaced by something else, something cold and foreign, something alive and hungry. I can still feel it, crawling around beneath the perfect pale skin of my now uninjured shoulder. Cetricus Ra flips a few switches on the console, and our little spherical ship powers up. The walls become translucent. It's the Mogadorian version of tinted glass, though we can see out, but no one can see in. I turn my head to study the docking bay that's crowded with combat-ready Mogadorians. They all stand perfectly still, hundreds of them, arranged in orderly lines, all of them with their fists clenched over their hearts. They're saluting their beloved leader as he sets out to conquer Earth. I look at their pasty, expressionless faces and their dark, empty eyes. Are these my people? Am I becoming one of them? It seems easiest to give in. Cetricus Ra is about to get us moving when a red light flashes on one of his video screens and a shrill buzzing sounds. The noise wakes me up a little. Some unlucky underling is trying to call Cetricus Ra right in the middle of his big day. Cetricus Ra's jaw sets in annoyance at the incoming message, and for a moment, I think he might ignore it. Finally, he jabs a button, and a frazzled Mogadori